Good morning, everyone. If anybody has lost a cell phone, we have had one turned in, so just come see us over at the AV table. All right, hi everyone. Let's get started here. There's some open seats over here if you're still looking. Welcome to the mic. Is that better? Yeah, okay. All right, let's do this. Welcome everyone to the first breakout session of the day. My name is Kirsten Pearl and I'll be your host. Couldn't be more excited to be here. It's really an honor to be a part of such an amazing conference, you know, to see this many women wanting to better themselves and believing in something, believing in their potential and here for it. It's really, really something special. I don't know if you heard either, but this conference sold out in 9 minutes, 10,000 tickets. Wow, right? Yeah, really amazing. So the session we have for you right now, you all picked a good room. This is the place to be. The art of talking about yourself, selling, branding, talking about yourself professionally. Now, this topic is important to me on a somewhat personal level. My day job, I work at CBRE, a global commercial real estate firm, and what feels right now like my 24/7 job, I also own a chocolate company out of Newburyport, Seacoast Sweets. Just finished my MBA a few weeks ago. Life is good. Everything's good. Thank you. Thanks. Thanks. Yeah, so, you know, even with this resume, though, I am still part of that generation that felt like we needed all the community service hours on our college application and, you know, the Fortune 500 internships to have a fighting chance at a decent job. It wasn't easy. Employers wanted someone aged 22 to 26 with 30 years experience, and it was a hard time. When I graduated from Bentley in 2010, when I graduated from Bentley in 2010, the job market was difficult. And now the market is strong, yet competition is still very fierce. And it's more important than ever to really make yourself a brand and to separate yourself from a piece of paper. What have you learned from your experience that adds value, which is a key word I think here, value to what you bring to the table? Now, our thought leader for the session, Aliza Licht, fashion communications executive and former Twitter phenom, DKNY PR girl, featured on the front page of the New York Times style section as one of America's Next Top Mentors, dubbed the reigning queen of social media by Women's Wear Daily, and called one of six women who rule the fashion world by time, style, and design. I'm going to keep going here because I'm sure you're just not impressed yet, right? It's, I'm sure if I said, you know, she styled Taylor Swift for the Golden Globes and Sofia Vergara for the SAG Awards, we're still just not there yet. So Lisa is a TEDx speaker, 5-time Fashion 2.0 award winner, and latest author of Leave Your Mark, Land Your Dream Job, Kill It in Your Career, Rock Social Media. It was Amazon's number one release for 2 months following its debut on the Job Hunting and Career Gags. This woman is the coolest. I'm pretty excited to now brag that I'm even in the same room as her. So without further ado, please put your hands together for Aliza Licht.
Thank you so much. Can you guys, is my mic on? Okay, good. Good morning, everyone. I'm thrilled to be here. I feel like I'm a regular now because I did Texas, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts. I'm just going around to all these conferences and it's inspiring every single time. I'm particularly excited about Massachusetts though because we have changed the format. I don't know if you guys know that, but because we have such amazing speakers on our panels, we decided the panel format actually doesn't work because, you know, sometimes people like to talk a lot about themselves, right? So we decided one-on-one is better. So the format today, I'm going to take you through some very quick things you can do to use as your weapon in personal branding. And then I'm going to bring on each panelist individually and give them individualized spotlight attention. And at the end, we'll save time for Q&A. So I wrote a book called Leave Your Mark. And one of the core principles of this book is how to build your personal brand. through my experience at DKNY, I worked at the company for 17 years, and I was formerly the head of global communications. And I built a Twitter following of over 530,000 people on social media. And through that experience, I have learned and distilled how to do that. So when you talk about how do you talk about yourself, the easiest way to start understanding how to talk about yourself is to actually figure out who you are. And I would love to know in this room right now, and be honest, if I walked up to you and I called you out on stage right now and I said, hey, what do you do? Who in this room would have an immediate answer that's polished and exact? Raise your hand. Okay, that's not enough hand, which means I'm really glad you're all here. Okay. So I'll run through really quickly. So the first way to do this, first and foremost, is write your bio. Write your bio. I love how you're all looking down. That's great. Write your bio in third person as if you were a reporter from the New York Times writing about yourself. Feels a little weird in the beginning. It is a little weird, but it will make you understand what your personal brand sounds like to other people. So once you do that, we start with online. Now, we all know it's much easier to hide behind a computer than it is to walk up to someone in the middle of a room like this and say, hey, I'm so-and-so, what do you do? So I'm going to walk you through some core steps on how to build your personal brand online first, and then we're going to talk about IRL in real life. So first of all, what you need to do is establish your personal brand's DNA. What do you stand for? What are things that you should talk about online, and what are things that you should avoid? That's called building your filter. And when you build your filter, and when I say build, I mean on paper, you will create a roadmap for yourself that's very clear, because we all know how much trouble one can get in online conversation. So when you talk about what you want to do and what you want to promote, think about that as it relates to the message you're giving off. The second thing is you have to decipher if you add value. When you talk about building a following in social media, you have to critique yourself and think, well, why would someone who doesn't actually know you in real life follow you on social media? Are you providing entertainment? Are you providing information? Are you giving someone a behind-the-scenes look into a world they would otherwise not have access to? And the other thing is, are you thinking about how much time you're spending only talking about yourself and promoting yourself? Because social media is a two-way street. Are you giving voice to powerful allies in your field that can help leverage your profile? You know, at the end of the day, when you ask someone a question on social media, they probably will answer it. And asking questions and sharing content is a great way to further deepen your connections and build your following. Are you curating the best version of yourself? I always tell people, before you pitch yourself to anyone for anything, take an audit of all of your online presence. Google yourself, look at your Twitter, look at your Facebook, look at every single thing you've posted. Clean it up and delete anything that could be misconstrued as something that doesn't align with your personal brand. And think about what message are you giving off, and ask yourself, would you hire you? Because it is Exhibit B after your resume. But then it goes in real life, right? And we can't discount in real life and what happens when you walk into a room to make a presentation or to speak in front of a crowd. What is your visual identity? Okay? People are judging everything. You walk into a room to pitch new business and you're in a suit that's wrinkled and looks like it hasn't been dry cleaned in months, guess what? They've already decided your capabilities. Think about if your visual identity matches not only your resume, but your verbal identity and your online identity? And do all of those things match the profession you're in? Are you an Uber connector? I have found, and I've actually paid very close attention to this, that the most successful women I know are the first people to say, who do you need me to introduce you to? And the first time someone said that to me, I was like, wow, that's so nice. Shit, do I do that for people? And I learned to think about, wow, what connections can I make other people? Because what happens is you end up putting so many favors in your back pocket, and you know you never forget those favors, right? And then you feel more comfortable asking for help when you need it. So be gracious when making introductions for other people, even if it has no visible benefit to you. The boomerang effect is real. And don't break the link. Use social as a way to keep up on your relationships. You know, I always feel like sending an email to someone in business, unless you have a reason, is kind of hard sometimes. You feel like, what am I just going to say, hi, how are you? Maybe, but it's a little bit awkward, especially if it's really a professional relationship and not a friendship. But keeping up with people on social media is way more comfortable. It's the biggest cocktail party in the world, and you're all invited. And nobody thinks it's weird when you jump into a conversation. But remember, keep up with your contacts when you don't need them. Okay? Don't think about them when you need something. You need to keep up with them when you don't need them so that when you do need them, it's not that obvious. And your elevator pitch. So when you leave here today, or at lunch today, or even after we're done with this, turn to the person next to you at some point and ask each other what each of you do. Your elevator pitch needs to be ready at all times. What do you do? That answer needs to be a soundbite that you practice in the mirror over and over again and that you think about and refine every time you're in front of a different audience. You know, in this day and age, a lot of us have a lot of hats that we wear. You know, Kristen has her chocolate business and she has her real estate. You know, you have to think about what answer is right depending on who the audience is and who you're networking with. So make sure you nail that. And every time you go out to an event, make sure you meet 3 new people. And follow up the next day and say, hey, it was great to meet you last night. Here's my contact. You know, keep in touch. That is how you build your network. That's my book. I'm signing books at 11. And now we will start the presentation. I hope I didn't take a lot of time. Okay, I didn't. Come on. Come upstairs. Come upstairs.
Wouldn't it be great if this walked up and tripped down the stairs?
Oh, my
fell right on my face.
We'll say it like this.
Hi, everybody.
I didn't want to remove the chairs because it was just too much work.
That's great.
So this is Kamal Harris, someone who I know and who I have enormous respect for. So you guys maybe didn't read your little notebooks clearly, but are you guys aware, like, this is who creates Claire Underwood? Are you guys House of Cards fans? Okay, I mean, obviously, you have an enormous roster of amazing clients, but, I mean, Robin Wright, I have a soft spot. Kamal is a top Hollywood celebrity stylist. She is Hollywood Reporter's number 3 most important stylist in the world. Right here, all for you.
Yikes.
Other clients include Olivia Wilde, Zooey Deschanel, and she recently, in season 3, transitioned from stylist to costumer for the show. So she does Robin Wright in real life, but then she started doing it on the actual show, which I think is amazing, and I can't wait. It comes back on in February. Mm-hmm. So, Kamal, you've been obsessed with fashion since age 4. And you used to draw fashion collections on the sand in Long Island?
I actually grew up in Long Beach, British Columbia.
Long Beach. That's from Long Island, so that's my natural...
Yeah. but that's how I... It just for some reason was in my brain. I would use that as my palette, and I would draw and sketch.
So you did ultimately study fashion design.
I did.
So you were on your path from minute one, basically.
That was my dream. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to pursue fashion. But I grew up in a super tiny town, 1,200 people, in a country not known for its, you know, fashion capitals. And I did deviate for a while studying anthropology at college because I was like, I need to go into something that's like a real job,
right,
or respected in the educational field. But I ended up falling back into fashion, trusting my gut, and it just felt like such a right, the right match, and here I am.
How do you feel, I mean, especially doing this, you know, for creating characters, how do you feel, you know, I spoke about visual identity before, mm-hmm, what role do you think fashion plays in the image that you present?
It's a ingredient in your whole recipe for success, for sure. And as you were saying in your presentation, it's one of the first things people will see. You know, when you walk into the room, and when I walk into the room, are they thinking she's a stylist or she's a janitor? You know, no offense to janitors, because that's your profession as well, but when you walk into the room, you want people to take notice to a certain degree. And one thing that I think is important, you know, I can spout trends and I can spout, you know, fashion advice, but honestly, what's worked for me is finding that thing about you that makes you special. All of us have a feature, a characteristic, a passion, a hobby. There's something in all of you that make you different from everybody else. And that's what, ultimately, I think an employer is looking for. When I first moved to New York and was working as a stylist in the fashion industry, I didn't fit the mold. I looked around and I was like, oh my gosh, do I have to be 6 feet tall and blonde? Wearing high heels and looking like a Vogue editor, you know, swishing onto set every day. And I attempted that and it failed miserably. I was so uncomfortable. I couldn't do my job. I couldn't perform. And I finally took a look in the mirror and I was like, who's the real me? And that's where I found my confidence. You know, the real me is a flat shoe wearing woman. I love my trousers. I love my tailored jackets. I wear my shaggy haircut, and I don't worry about what the next person is wearing. So it's really finding that one thing that you think makes you different. And obviously, you can't maybe dress in, you know, your purple and green combinations if that's your passion, you know, if you're in the courtroom. So you have to sort of adjust it to your actual occupation.
What are the biggest fashion mistakes you see people do that you're just like, okay, don't ever, ever, ever do again?
Well, it does go back to finding what works for you. So, like, my own personal fashion mistake was trying to dress a way that wasn't me. And you can tell in the body language. You know, a lot of people, if they've got a big, important interview coming up, the first thought is, oh, I've got to run out to Barney's or, you know, buy an expensive new outfit or some brand new shoes so I can really look, you know, polished and presentable. And you put on that outfit and you're like, for all outward purposes, I look amazing, but these shoes are killing my feet. You know, this waist is pinching, the waistline's pinching my stomach. I'm like, you're so worried about your outfit that you can't let your confidence shine. And I think that's a huge mistake.
What pieces do you think every professional person should have in their closet?
I think just for women on the go, the best secret is just fill your closet with your foundation pieces and your basics. So having your perfect jacket, your perfect tailored trouser, you know, if you're a skirt or a dress person, you know, everything tailored and your great essential basics, because after that, you can really play. And that's where you can kind of create your identity. So if you're a jewelry person, your thing is, like, I love to wear giant earrings every day, and I have a collection of giant earrings, and that's what people remember about me, and it makes me feel unique. Then if you've got your basic wardrobe already established, you can play with that.
Really interesting. Now, making the leap, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, this is how I feel right now. Is anyone in here trying to reinvent their career, to go from one job to a totally different job? Raise of hands. Okay. You're not a trained customer, right? So how did you make that leap? How did you pitch yourself to go from stylist to customer on a TV show like that?
It was scary, but luckily I actually did study fashion design, so I understand construction of wardrobe and pattern making and understanding how fabrics hang. I think if you want to change your career or take a different turn in your career, obviously if you could squeeze in a night class or do some online learning to sort of understand the foundation of that industry, that would be helpful. It was a lot of asking questions and not being afraid to, you know, speak up if I didn't understand what was happening. I was very fortunate to have the support of Robin because I'd already worked with her for Red Carpet. And so it was more of a natural progression for me. Mm-hmm. But I think you can have a career change at any time in your life. You know, I didn't start styling until I turned 30. So that's, you know, that was a huge, I quit my day job. I'm like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to jump in with both feet. And there's mistakes to be made if you are, you know, worrying about multi-million dollar budgets and, you know, a lot of people's, you're responsible for a lot of people's livelihood and jobs. But if it's just yourself and you're starting out, I really think there's no mistakes. You're going to learn from everything.
It's really a good
it's
point.
It's really worth it to take the risk.
I agree. All right, give us some Hollywood styling secrets. I know you've got an arsenal of them.
Oh, they're so basic, but they're things that get overlooked all the time. Making sure that you have your essential foundations fitting properly. When I say that, your bras, your Spanx, your pantyhose. Like, if you are feeling uncomfortable or unsupported underneath your clothes, it shows. So it's worth it to take the time. And it's like, something you never think about, really. Also, tailoring. If there's really nobody who can walk into a store and buy something straight off the rack and have it fit perfectly, unless you are a fit model. And every designer uses a different fit model. So don't be disappointed when you walk into, you know, a certain designer's store and you can't find anything to fit you or everything's too long. If you've got a great dry cleaner that you trust and they've maybe got a seamstress in the back or a tailor anywhere in your neighborhood that can add a hem, you know, take in a, you know, take in the waistline, just those little tweaks will make everything fit you. Even if you just bought the jacket at Zara, it doesn't matter. I think it's worth it.
Great. Do you guys know that Robin Wright was just nominated for several awards this season? So Kamal has a very busy awards season ahead, and I cannot wait to see what you put her in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much
for
being here. It was great. Thanks, guys. Yvette. Now we're joined by Yvette Hillal. I'm just going to not move. I'm just going to sit here.
It's too bad I'm following Kamal. I'm reassessing everything I'm wearing.
It's funny. It's a learning curve, right?
What does this say?
No, you look great. So Yvette is the Vice President of Human Resources for the Laboratory Equipment Division at Thermo Fisher. And Hillal has more than 20 years of human resources experience. So she's got a lot of great tips for you today. She joined Thermo Fisher in 2008 and has held several roles within the company. And today we're going to pull all your brain cells out of your brain to help everyone here so they understand what they should be doing on interviews. So in your experience, having seen so many candidates, what advice do you have for women specifically who are seeking to get hired?
Sure. So I think before the interview even, right, I think that a lot of people ask, what is the best way to just find a role? And it really is all about building your network and building your brand as well, as we've been talking about. You have to be very clear on what it is that you're looking for, what it is that you have to know who you are and what you're offering. So once you build your network, right, let's say that you do get a call and you get to the interview stage, I think that there's really no shortcut for preparation. Do your homework. Do your homework about the company. Do your homework about the people you're going to meet. Make sure that you do the due diligence. It still amazes me how many people come to an interview and you ask a question that you feel like this should have been an expected question. And, you know, the look is, oh, good question. Let me think about that. Well, the time to think about it was before you came to the interview. So I would say preparation is so key. It's hard work, but really you're competing, right? So you have to go in with as much ammunition as possible. And you don't just show up to an interview and wonder, what are they going to ask me, right? And then make it up in the moment. You have to come armed with information, with examples. Can I? There's a really good trick that I've shared with many people I know that I would recommend that you do. I've been working for many, many years. I use index cards. Throughout my career, if I have a really good experience that I feel like this is a good story I may want to tell at some point, I put it on an index card with details. What was the situation? Who was involved? By name. So that when you go to an interview, well, you can review them before you go to the interview. And once you're there, most interviews are behavioral. They're going to ask you, tell me about a time when, or give me an example of.
This is great advice.
And you can just think about your index card and said, even if it was 10 years ago, oh yes, I've had to lead a project of that size. Here was the situation. I worked with Julian, you know, Michael, whatever, and you're just spot on. If you haven't done that homework, you're going to be caught off guard and you're going to be thinking, oh God, give me an example.
So true. So let me ask you a question, you know, and I think there's debate on this. Some people come into a job application process and they're like, you know what, I'll take any job. I'll work in any department, I'll do PR, I'll do marketing, I'll be the receptionist, I'll do anything. Versus someone who's super focused with an objective like, my goal is to work in marketing. Do you have any sort of judgment on which way to go? Is it better to be really focused and specific, or is it better to show that you're willing to do anything?
Great question. So I have a bit of a bias with that. I think that you should be very, very focused for that situation. That's not to say that you can't have multiple elevator pitches, right? Depending on the company, the person you're talking to. So you can be focused in a couple of different areas, but when you're really going into that discussion with a person who matters to your future and you're really asking them for help, it's really hard to help someone who's not clear on what they want. In human resources, we have people that come into our offices frequently and say, so they're already in the company, but they say, I'd like to advance my career. I'd like to take that next step. Can you help me? And you start with, right, great. So what do you want to do? Oh, I don't know. It could be this. It could be that. It could be that. For me, trying to help them, it's very difficult because that doesn't put me on a straight path to be able to help that person. So I have a little bit of a bias toward, I think it's good to be open to a lot of possibilities, but in a conversation with someone who might be of help, mm-hmm. I think you want to help them help you by being very clear on what you want and how they can help.
So another question I often get, and I'm curious what you think, is a lot of job postings are online. You submit your resume through, you know, this black hole, which I envision is like something out of, you know, Harry Potter or Smeagol or anything from like Lord of the Rings. And I always feel like that's like the kiss of death. Do you feel that someone should be doing both submitting through the proper channels online per the request of the company and also digging around to find a human contact and pitching them as well?
No doubt. It's absolutely the best way. And these days, I think there's so many opportunities through LinkedIn, for example. If you're applying for a particular company, you can see if there's somebody in your network who knows somebody in the company, make an introduction. In some cases, you're competing against so many different people that it really gives you the edge if you know somebody who can at least make an introduction and position you a little bit ahead of just the rest of the world who's applying for that job.
Give us some tips on negotiating a salary.
Sure.
Are you supposed to tell the truth about what you make? Are you supposed to hedge it by, say, $10,000? I'm totally not speaking from experience, guys. I'm just asking. what's the deal with that? Because
sure.
I think people in the Pennsylvania conference, a girl came up to me after I moderated a similar panel, and she said that her male counterpart makes about $20,000 more than her, and
right.
she knows for a fact.
Right.
And she went in for a raise, and they declined her. So she was saying that she feels like she needs to get a new job, but she doesn't know if she should up her salary now by the $20,000 she knows the guy was making for this future job, or
can they check?
Yeah, no, never lie. Not about your salary, not about anything in the interview process. It will backfire in a big way. Yeah, we will check, absolutely. So you don't want to approach it from that perspective, but you can go in having in mind the salary that you do want and that you know you're worth, given the value that you bring to the company. And even if it does come up that the person that you're pitching to knows your salary, you know, you can always set that aside and really have the focus on the value that you're going to bring to them, to the company, to the firm in this role and why you're worth that. So the focus should be on that, and they shouldn't be thinking about it in terms of incremental to what you were making, this is how much you're going to get. You really should always think about it in terms of this is what I'm worth because of the accomplishments I'm going to have.
And is it poor form for that girl to mention that she knew a counterpart's salary in her previous role?
Yes. I think that whether you're seeking a job or seeking a promotion, it's about you and what you bring. It's not about pointing to others and say, well, this person got promoted, how come I didn't, right? Nobody likes that. I mean, it's really just, it's always, the story is about me and what I bring and why I'm worth that.
What are some don't do's that you've seen, besides obviously don't not prepare, things like that? What are things that you hear that it's like nails on a chalkboard? Like you just can't believe that people continuously make these mistakes when
speaking
about themselves?
Do you want me to
have
an HR catharsis right here or later?
But like when people, you know, it's hard because, you know, there's a balance I would imagine between talking about yourself in a way that's confident and you're expressing your skills, where then you head into this borderline, like, really braggatory situation.
Right.
Like, what's the tone? What are the kind of words? Yeah. Like, what's the balance you need to strike that you don't, that the interviewer doesn't walk away thinking, like, I hate this person?
So true. I mean, it's really interesting as I was thinking about this topic of promoting yourself, right? You do want to promote yourself during the interview or at work in order to get ahead, get promoted, but you don't want to be a self-promoter. Nobody likes the self-promoters, right? So it's kind of a dilemma. I want to promote myself, but I don't want to be a self-promoter. So it's all about striking the right tone. It's kind of like I was thinking this morning at our booth in Thermos Fisher Scientific, people were getting their makeup on, and makeup is great in the right amount, and then if you overdo it, it just doesn't really look good. So in the interview as well, you don't want to overdo it. And I think there's a couple of tips that I can give you for setting that right tone, right? The first one we talked about a little bit, being authentic. Kamal talked about this, right? You really can't try to pretend to be somebody that you're not. So you don't want to try to sound like some other person. You have to be you. And in order to be you, you have to know you. So know your strengths. Don't oversell in areas where you know that if you actually had to do the job, you would come up short. The second one, which I really enjoy, is I love it when people talk about themselves by talking about others and what they've done in the service of others. So I was interviewing someone the other day, and it was for a leadership position, and I asked her, tell me about a time when you've really developed somebody to the next level of their career. And she lit up and said, let me tell you about Julie. Julie, I hired Julie, and I did this, and I exposed her to this experience, and then I gave her this responsibility, and she just shone. And then she's been promoted. So it's funny because she's talking about what she did, but she's not being so explicit about it that it comes across as arrogant.
I like that.
So for me, she implicitly told me what a great leader she is, but by telling the story of Julie and what she did for Julie.
Great advice. Thank you so much, Yvette.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're just rolling through this list. Nzinga, come join the stage.
Thank you.
This is Nzinga Shah, everyone.
Hi, everyone.
Now, Nzinga has a very interesting title, but also I'm going to give the caveat of this. She's the first person to have this role. She is the Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer of the Atlanta Hawks Basketball Club.
Go Hawks.
She is the first person, wait for it, she's the first person to hold this position in the National Basketball Association, and for all North American professional sports teams, including the NFL, the MLB, the NHL, and the MLS. If all of you know what those letters stand for, I applaud you. My husband would, like, be mortified right now. Shaw also serves as a member of the executive committee and provides guidance to the leadership team so they can engender inclusivity in every facet of the business. So this is a very modern job.
Yes.
It's a very modern job. How did you even come to get this job?
You know, it's interesting. I created this role. Thank you. I was working at Edelman, which is the world's largest PR agency, as the head of diversity and inclusion, and I was also a crisis counselor there. And while I was at Edelman, I got a phone call from a law firm in the Atlanta area that said they needed crisis counseling for a sports organization that would be going through something that potentially could be very public, very ugly, and involve race in sports. That's all they told me. And so,
that sounds fun.
Yeah, right? And this is like the week after the Donald Sterling LA Clippers situation. So I went to the law firm, and I ended up meeting with the CEO and the general counsel of the Atlanta Hawks, and they told me about a situation that became very public in which our controlling owner and general manager made very racially disparaging remarks towards the African-American fan base, and they said these things on a board call that was taped. The tape was going to leak, et cetera, et cetera. So I ended up becoming a part of the crisis team to manage communications for all that would happen after this, and ultimately said to the leadership team, you guys need someone to really look after diversity and inclusion on a full-time basis, because if this just happened with the LA Clippers and now it's happening with your sports organization, undoubtedly it's going on throughout the league, and so you should really think about leading in this space. And they decided to create the role, and I applied for it, and here I am a year later.
Wow, that's amazing. Amazing. And let's not discount the fact you are in a male-dominated industry. So talk to us about being a woman in your field, in your job.
Sure. I mean, it certainly can be very challenging. My organization is probably 80% male, 20% women. And then when you look at the higher levels of the organization, it really falls off from there. Coupled with the fact that I'm also African American, I mean, I'm certainly very unique in the boardroom situations that I'm in, but I think that the way that I've been able to be successful with all these differences is to establish myself as an expert in my field. Men really, really like it when you know exactly what you're talking about and when you're able to add value beyond anybody else in the room. And so in the different situations that I've been in professionally, working at the National Football League, working at the New York Yankees, and now the Atlanta Hawks, I really have seen that there's a disparity when we look at diversity and inclusion and who we hire in full-time roles, who we allow to ascend to top positions. And so I have made myself an expert in the diversity and inclusion space, which has really lent itself in a positive way when we do new business pitches, when we try to build organically businesses that we already have, and just when we think about new and unexpected talent that we bring into the building for new roles. So because I've established myself as an expert in my field, I think that the men that I interact with in my organization are more comfortable.
And how do you're in a meeting with, 20 men on something, and everyone's, talking at random. How do you make yourself heard? How do you establish that level of respect in a boardroom situation when things get heated or you don't agree? Or how do you present what is your tone like?
Well, first and foremost, you have to have confidence when you're dealing with a room filled with men. I mean, if they see that you are apprehensive at all, they will eat you alive. So I am always confident. I'm always assured of myself when I go into those situations. But then I also, again, I add a nuance or some type of value to the conversation that they are not bringing to the conversation. So I'll give you guys an example. About 6 months ago, we decided to erect a statue of Dominique Wilkins, who's a Hall of Famer and Atlanta Hawks legend, in front of our arena. And so when we were thinking about the best way to present this statue and to create programming around it, the men in the room, they put all of the best men in the world on the agenda. So they wanted our CEO to talk. They wanted ex-coaches to talk. They wanted current players to talk. There were no women involved in the program. And I raised my hand and I said, we really, really need to think about inclusivity in every form. We have to have a woman in this program. Undoubtedly, there is some woman in Dominique's life that has touched him in an immense way, whether it's his wife, his mother, perhaps a teacher. We've got to hear that voice. And all of the men looked at me and go, whoa, that is genius. And I'm like, what? I just try to add value and think about things that men wouldn't think about, and certainly feel self-assured enough to bring those topics up.
So, I mean, everywhere you go, you turn on the TV, I mean, we can talk about Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper and the pay gap and all that stuff. I mean, what do you think is the best way? I mean, you've been there a year, so maybe by next year you're thinking maybe you need some sort of little promotion. How are you going to ask for that? What are you going to go in there and say?
So I think when you ask for a promotion, you have to talk about where we were and where we are and where we can go. And so if I were to think about positioning myself for the next move, I would certainly outline where the organization was before I even took on this role, right? So we were in the middle of a crisis that was very public. Our brand was at stake. Our season ticket holders were at stake. Our fan base didn't believe in us. I took on this role, and since taking on this role, I've been able to establish a diversity and inclusion council, not only made up of members of the Atlanta Hawks organization, but also comprised of people that are key stakeholders in the city of Atlanta. That way, multiple voices and perspectives are being heard before we start to develop new initiatives. We've also been the first NBA team to march in the Pride Parade and have taken a very strong stance to support the LGBT community. Next week, we will have our first wedding proposal of a lesbian couple during our Kiss Cam. So, you know, really talking about the different things that I've been able to implement since taking on this role and then positioning myself for future projects and really setting out a vision and a path for where we can go and how we can continue to lead the NBA. So if I do that and I say it in an assured way, hopefully I will be able to position myself for a promotion. You may not get a promotion the first time you set the stage, but I think that even allowing your managers and your supervisors to know that that's where you want to go, you may not get it right away, but at least it will keep you in mind for future opportunities when the time is right. Everything is not always good timing. Just because it's the time that you want it to be doesn't mean that it's right for the organization, but I would just say be persistent and persevere and continue to add value and show why you're important, and eventually it'll work out for you.
So I think that, I mean, this is great feedback, but, you know, a lot of times people sit there and think, like, being confident is a lot easier said than done, right? So tell me about a time where you either faked it and gave off the impression that you were confident, or a time where you really weren't and how you learned from that situation. Because I think that a lot of times it's really intimidating. Not everyone can sit in a room with 20 men and give their opinion, right? Or not everyone, when they're going in for a job interview, can sell themselves well. So what are your tips for either overcoming failure or creating confidence that doesn't necessarily exist?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that you have to be honest about what you know and what you don't know. And so it is okay to put forth an idea and it gets shot down. And it doesn't mean that you're a failure or that you don't know what you're talking about. Again, like I said earlier, everything is not always going to make sense in the moment. But I think that the exercise of being able to express yourself, that's really what's critical. Not whether or not they adopt your idea or adopt the program, but being able to self-assuredly say, this is what I think and this is why I think it. And it takes practice. It takes a lot of practice. Perhaps you can use your peers to shoot off ideas with before going to the actual boardroom and before going to the big boss to talk about it. I think you have to certainly have mentors, both inside of your organization and outside of your organization, that can listen to your idea and give you feedback on whether or not you've positioned it in the right way. So don't just go into a blind situation and put your best idea forward without vetting it with others, because you may be able to actually gain more insight if you talk to someone first.
Great answer. Thank you so much. Santana. Running out of time. That was great. I love what you said about not being afraid to be wrong. I think that paralyzes a lot of people in not wanting to participate in a conversation. And I think that more women would be heard if they weren't afraid to be wrong. Chantal, welcome. This is Chantal Roderbay, everyone. She is the founder and CEO of Chloe and Isabel. She is a lifelong entrepreneur who has supported herself since age 13. Can you just even, I'm sorry, my son is 11 and I can't fathom what that means.
I left home at 13.
You left home at 13.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a whole nother story.
We need more time.
That would take a whole nother, yeah.
So you've had a successful career as a jewelry and a retail executive, and you launched Chloe and Isabel in 2011. And your mission was to create a social retailing platform to empower the next generation of female entrepreneurs. Such a noble cause. So, Chloe, besides being, 40 under 40 list in Fortune, Business Insider recognized her as best new startup of the year, you've had amazing experience, retail experience, but I want to talk to you most about how you think, or what you think the difference is between presenting yourself versus presenting the brand that you work at. Like, how do you strike a balance? Like, in this day and age, we all talk about personal branding. So when you work at a company, where do you find the balance between propelling yourself forward and the brand forward?
Okay. So I kind of think about your personal brand and your company's brand in a similar way. And it's really around sort of like, what is the purpose and the position? So what's your mission? You know, what are you trying to accomplish? And this is something that, because our role is empowering these entrepreneurs, is constantly asking them, like, think about what your goals are. Like, what do you want to accomplish? And then your position is really, what makes you unique and different? And those questions can be answered whether you're a company or a person, and it will help you even create that path forward. And what are the most important prioritizations, or what are the goals for you within a brand as a person or a brand as a company?
When you were looking to start your business, did you have to pitch for funding? Like, how did you sort of sell your idea? Like, how did you make people believe in what you were trying to do?
Yes, well, definitely had to sell people. And I didn't know. Ignorance was bliss. I'm so grateful that I didn't know then what I know now.
Really? So don't listen, because obviously...
Yeah, if you're trying to raise money, don't listen to anything I'm about to say. No, I had never met a venture capitalist before. You know, I climbed the corporate ladder. All I knew was retail and fashion, and I accidentally stumbled my way in front of a VC, and I didn't know that I wasn't the norm, that I wasn't the profile of what they invest in. And I didn't even know that I had to put together a deck. I mean, I remember the first time I met with a VC, I just sat in a hotel lobby with some jewelry that I had designed for another designer and just started talking. And little did I know, I should have had like this proper presentation and did all these things. So I put together a little 12-page slide and really just explained why I'm uniquely suited to do this. It wasn't even a strategic thought, it was just real. I'm really passionate about what I'm doing. I want to make an impact, and I've spent my entire career building the skill set that I need to be successful. So when later on, once I discovered like, oh wow, this was a stretch for them, I said, why did you do this? Why did you invest? And they said, because if anyone's going to be successful doing this, it's you, because of your experience. So be, you know, really aware of taking steps that are building towards that goal, that are going to help you position why it's you. Because anybody can have the idea, and anybody can copy an idea, but what makes you uniquely suited to actually execute the idea?
Interesting. Are you one of these, like, you've got, like, your 10-year plan, like, mapped out? Like, do you have, like, a
yes.
flow chart in your apartment?
It's interesting, because I didn't realize also kind of how, I think it's incredibly important to be, I'm a planner, I plan everything. I think that I planned it from fifth grade on. I mean, it's crazy when I look back at it, but I think it's important to have short-term goals because you need to know if you're on track for your goals. So yes, have a 10-year plan. I mean, that's kind of extreme. But definitely have a 1-year plan, a 3-year plan, and a 5-year plan, because you could wake up one day and 5 years have passed and you don't really know if you're on track. I'll give you an example of this. When I was 21, I had landed in corporate buying. And over the course of that year, so from 21 to 22, I had some realizations. I said, I want to have my own jewelry company one day. And I would like to become an expert in jewelry. So I would like to see if I can climb the corporate ladder, but never leave jewelry. That's a tough thing to do when you're a buyer. They're wanting to promote you in all sorts of different places, and it's hard to say no to a promotion because they're going to put you in apparel or in home or wherever you could end up.
That's interesting.
And so I had to sit down and talk to my boss and say, can I get promoted and stay in jewelry? And I realized at that point that I had that there was a path where I had to end. And so I charted out my path on how I could go from Target Corp to Macy's to Gap so that I could continue to climb but stay within the jewelry world. But I had to really plan that out or it would have never happened.
It's very strategic. Very, very interesting. So, I'm sure half the people in this room, or more than half, have like an idea that they're like, oh, I should do that, right? I mean, I do. I'll never do it. I don't know why, but I won't, right? How do you coach yourself into actually taking the plunge? Because I think, like, we're all full of really good ideas, but it just seems so daunting. It just seems like, oh, you know, by the time I figure that out, someone else is going to copy it, or whatever. I mean, it just seems like too much.
To create the plan, the goals?
To just do it. to live the Nike dream. You just can't do it. What do you advise?
There's no time like the present. That's interesting. I feel like it's so much fun to accomplish things. So I guess, I mean, maybe that's just personality traits. I'm not sure. I would say, like, it feels so good to move forward and to accomplish things that I would hope that just knowing the fact that you have these goals, it's sort of like, even when you think about all of this branding, like you talked about, what are the words that you'd like to use to describe yourself? You know, we've talked a lot about what it means to have that personal brand. I mean, I would challenge everyone to sit down and say, what are the 3 words that I would like to describe myself with? Like, what are those 3 words? In a perfect world, this is what people would say. And then I would have kind of a reality check and say, okay, what 3 words do I think people would say to describe me? Mm-hmm. And then if you can, find a way to either ask your boss or your peer or someone else to somehow get the other side of how they would describe it and figure out how you can bridge that gap, and that will help you even decide what actions you need to take. Sometimes that goal, like for me, it was, I want to be a jewelry expert. Mm-hmm. I want to be considered a risk taker. And when I saw if there's some sort of misalignment, you can begin to build that roadmap to accomplish those things because you know what your brand message is.
Are you highly caffeinated?
No.
Just curious. I just like to know how much coffee people drink to do all these things, start their own businesses.
I haven't even had a cup today. Like, I keep drinking.
So now I don't like her. See? Thank you so much. I'd like to ask everyone to join us up here for a quick Q&A. Thank you guys so much. This is super, super interesting. Any questions from the audience, please go to the microphones in the middle or scream on the top of your lungs, whichever you prefer. Yes.
Hi, my name is Catherine Storing, and I have a question for you guys. When do you decide, I want to do this, and how do you break into the fashion world? I want to be a fashion stylist, and I just wanted to hear from you.
Kamal, it's all you, babe. Where's your mic? Why is your mic not happening?
Hello. Okay. There I am. I worked a full-time job Monday to Friday. I wanted to be a fashion stylist. I realized it's something I wanted to do. I reached out to fashion design schools, so I reached out and made contact with students. I made contact with young photographers and the local model agencies. I found contacts at the grassroots because I had no experience. And we started to work together on creative projects. Eventually that led to a portfolio and led to me working with higher,
oh, I love that,
better respected people in the field. That's great. In a nutshell.
Thank you.
Great. Next question.
My My question is, what is the number one work-life balance tips that you wonderful women can give us? Because I feel like I'm on the right path for my career, but I feel like every day I'm like a hamster on the wheel, just running, running, running. I am exhausted.
Who wants to take that? Any moms on the panel?
That was a work-life balance.
Yeah.
As a mother of two, and doing all those things sort of simultaneously, I learned how to really focus my time. So there was a point where I felt like I was actually being a really bad mom because I was working all the time, and I just made that conscious decision to put 200% into whatever I was doing, and I set timelines. So when it's the weekend, I'm with my family, and I do nothing but that. But during the week, I'm completely focused, because if you're doing everything a little bit, it's hard to do anything really well. So you just have to be really careful about how you divide the time and be committed to it.
I will add to that. You can't say yes to everything. You know, I limit going out during the week. You can go out in fashion. You can go to 4 events a night if you wanted to. I go out once a week because my kids have homework, and they're in 5th grade and 2nd grade, and I want to not be that mom. Of course, my daughter was like, I hate your book. You're going to Massachusetts again. But damn, you're going to get that, right? All right, we got to go super fast. Next question. Thank you.
Is it Nzinga?
Sure, Nzinga.
Nzinga?
Nzinga.
Nzinga, which I pronounced correctly. How do you see this role that you have evolving into not just your league or your team, but the league as a whole? Because I work in IT, and I'm like, I want to work with you. And so I they need the evolving of you need to be a middle person in between. So how do you see this evolving from you being the first person to the second, third, fourth after?
So it's such a great question. We actually have a second now. So about 4 months after I started, the NBA hired their first chief diversity and inclusion officer. His name is Horace Stewart. He and I work really closely, and we're actually working on a project right now to get this role embedded in all 30 teams. So probably within the next 3 years, you'll see it in all 30 teams.
I live in Boston. I represent Celtics.
Next question.
Oh. I'd like to touch on what Chantel stated about choosing 3 words, how you'd like to describe yourself. What's a good way of figuring out, like, how people see you and how to improve upon that?
How do you get the how people? So I think, you know, one way is you can ask your boss. And your boss, in order to get, like, the proper feedback, because I know there's going to want to be positive, I would specifically ask to give 3 words that they think are, of course, the normal, which are going to be probably positive, but I would also ask for the constructive words, because I think sometimes you have to ask for them and be aware of, like, where do you think I could improve, and what are those 3 words, so that you don't not get them.
But make sure you trust the source, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, ask a range of people, for sure, from peers to friends.
Okay,
so
next question.
In a room full of men, you say be confident. How do you be confident and be mistaken at the same time?
And be what?
Mistaken.
Was that for me?
Anybody.
I didn't hear the second word.
Her question is, in a room full of men, how can you be confident but yet mistaken?
Yeah.
I think that the way that you assert yourself, it's got to be very measured. If you are abrasive, that's never going to be embraced by anybody. I think there's a way to confidently explain your point of view without offending or treating anyone badly, even if they treat you that way. I think always treat others with respect, and you'll get your point across. Yep.
You guys, I have to leave to go to a book signing, but if you guys can hang out for a few minutes.
Absolutely.
And take those questions, that'd be great. Thank you, everyone, so much.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you.